File 58. It was probably the very parliamentarian skill displayed by the chief of the navy during the years of peace, which later became the cause of the fatal collapse, since parliamentarian considerations had begun to play a more important role in the construction of the navy than fighting considerations. The irresolution, the weakness, and the failure to adopt a logically consistent policy, which is typical of the parliamentary system, contaminated the naval authorities. As I have already emphasized, the military authorities did not allow themselves to be led astray by such fundamentally erroneous ideas. Ludendorff, who was then a colonel in the general staff, led a desperate struggle against the criminal vacillations with which the Reichstag treated the most vital problems of the nation, and in most cases voted against them. If the fight which this officer then waged remained unsuccessful, this must be debited to the Parliament, and partly also to the wretched and weak attitude of the Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg. Yet those who are responsible for Germany's collapse do not hesitate now to lay all the blame on the shoulders of the one man who took a firm stand against the neglectful manner in which the interests of the nation were managed. But one falsehood more or less makes no difference to these congenital tricksters. Anybody who thinks of all the sacrifices which this nation has had to bear as a result of the criminal neglect of those irresponsible individuals, anybody who thinks of the number of those who died or were maimed unnecessarily, anybody who thinks of the deplorable shame and dishonor which has been heaped upon us, and of the illimitable distress into which our people are now plunged, anybody who realizes that in order to prepare the way to a few seats in Parliament for some unscrupulous place hunters and arrivists will understand that such hirelings can be called by no other name than that of rascal and criminal, for otherwise those words could have no meaning. In comparison with traitors who betrayed the nation's trust, every other kind of twister may be looked upon as an honorable man. It was a peculiar feature of the situation that all the real faults of the old Germany were exposed to the public gaze only when the inner solidarity of the nation could be injured by doing so. Then, indeed, unpleasant truth were openly proclaimed in the ears of the broad masses, while many other things were at times shamefully hushed up, or their existence simply denied, especially at times when an open discussion of such problems might have led to an improvement in their regard. The higher government authorities knew little or nothing of the nature and use of propaganda in such matters. Only the Jew knew that by an able and persistent use of propaganda, heaven itself can be presented to the people as if it were hell, and, vice versa, the most miserable kind of life can be presented as if it were paradise. The Jew knew this, and acted accordingly. But the German, or rather his government, did not have the slightest suspicion of it. During the war, the heaviest of penalties had to be paid for that ignorance. Over against the innumerable drawbacks which I have mentioned here, and which affected German life before the war, there were many outstanding features on the positive side. If we take an impartial survey, we must admit that most of our drawbacks were in great measure prevalent also in other countries and among the other nations, and very often in a worse form than with us. whereas among us there were many real advantages which the other did not have. The leading phase of Germany's superiority arose from the fact that, almost alone among all the other European nations, the German nation had made the strongest effort to preserve the national character of its economic structure, and for this reason was less subject than other countries to the power of international finance, though indeed there were many untoward symptoms in this regard also. And yet, this superiority was a perilous one, and turned out later to be one of the chief causes of the World War. But even if we disregard this advantage of national independence in economic matters, there were certain other positive features of our social and political life which were of outstanding excellence. These features were represented by three institutions which were constant sources of regeneration. In their respective spheres, they were models of perfection, and were partly unrivaled. The first of these was the staple form as such, and the manner in which it had been developed for Germany in modern times. Of course, we must accept those monarchs who, as human beings, were subject to the failings which afflict this life and its children. If we were not so tolerant in these matters, then the case of the present generation would be hopeless. For if we take into consideration the personal capabilities and character of the representative figures in our present regime, it would be difficult to imagine a more modest level of intelligence and moral character. If we measure the value of the German Revolution by the personal worth and caliber of the individuals whom this revolution has presented to the German people since November 1918, then we may feel ashamed indeed in thinking of the judgment which posterity will pass on these people, when the law for the protection of the Republic can no longer silence public opinion. Coming generations will surely decide that the intelligence and integrity of our new German leaders were in adverse ratio to their boasting and their vices. It must be admitted that the monarchy had become alien in spirit to many citizens, and especially the broad masses. This resulted from the fact that the monarchs were not always surrounded by the highest intelligence, so to say, and certainly not always by persons of the most upright character. Unfortunately, many of them preferred flatterers to honest-spoken men, and hence received their information from the former. This was a source of grave danger at a time when the world was passing through a period in which many of the old conditions were changing, and when this change was affecting even the traditions of the court. The average man or woman could not have felt a wave of enthusiasm surging within the breast when, for example, at the turn of the century, a princess in uniform and on horseback had the soldiers file past her on parade. Those high circles had apparently no idea of the impression which such a parade made on the minds of ordinary people, else such unfortunate occurrences would not have taken place. The sentimental humanitarianism, not always very sincere, which was professed in those high circles, was often more repulsive than attractive. When, for instance, the Princess X condescended to taste the products of a soup kitchen and found them excellent, as usual, such a gesture might have made an excellent impression in times long past, but on this occasion it had the opposite effect to what was intended. For even if we take it for granted that Her Highness did not have the slightest idea that on the day she sampled it, the food was not quite the same as on other days, It sufficed that the people knew it. Even the best of intentions thus became an object of ridicule or a cause of exasperation. Descriptions of the proverbial frugality practiced by the monarch, his much too early rise in the morning and the drudgery he had to go through all day long until late at night, and especially the constantly expressed fears lest he might become undernourished, all this gave rise to ominous expression on the part of the people. Nobody was keen to know what and how much the monarch ate or drank. Nobody grudged him a full meal or the necessary amount of sleep. Everybody was pleased when the monarch, as a man and a personality, brought honour on his family and his country, and fulfilled his duties as a sovereign. All the legends which were circulated about him helped little, and did much damage.